Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. We have got a great show for you today, one that really explores the variety of what people in our local Central Indiana food community are up to. First, we'll stop by the office of Garden Party Hard Soda in downtown Indianapolis and talk with entrepreneur Erin Eds, who, along with her husband Steven, is launching a new beverage company here in Indianapolis and releasing their first products, two varieties of hard sodas. We'll talk with Erin about her professional journey from farmer's market vendor to Hoosier Mama Bloody Mary Mix co-founder to president of Garden Party Hard Sodas. And we'll hear about what it takes to create and roll out a brand new product. Then we'll head out to Shelby County and the Duggar Family Farm near Morristown, where Farm Indiana editor Sherry Duggar and her husband Randy have opened a store to bring fresh local food to their rural community. We'll also head back into the kitchen and revisit a favorite cook this segment with Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen, who we'll be talking more with next week. So stay with us for lots more on local food here on Eat Drink Indie Radio, on WFYI and WFYI.org. Farmers markets have become something of a launch pad lately for food entrepreneurs looking for a low barrier way to get their products out in front of the public. One local entrepreneur took that route about 8 years ago, and her journey since then has been inspiring to watch. Shoppers first met Erin Eds and her sister Katie at farmers markets when they began selling their sauces, spreads, dressings, and drinks as Country Mouse City Mouse. Their products quickly took off and eventually made their way into stores as well. Then Erin came up with a Bloody Mary recipe and co-founded Hoosier Mama, a line of culinary cocktail mixes. After leaving that company, she and her husband Steven went back to the drawing board and spent considerable time developing their next product, a line of botanical hard sodas. Garden Party Botanical Hard Sodas has just launched, and consumers will soon find two versions in local stores, sodas called Ruby and Violet. I stopped in at the new Garden Party office in downtown Indianapolis this past week to talk with Erin about her entrepreneurial adventures and to find out just how it all happened.
I grew up with a mom who owned a catering company. And so, you know, food has been a part of my sister and I's life for, you know, as long as we can remember. And I was a new mom. I had, you know, left the corporate world, not corporate world, but, you know, 9-to-5 world. And wanted to have something that I could do and still be a, you know, very active part of my new baby's life. And so I took some recipes that my sister and I developed with our family influences. And in May of 2008, we launched our first brand, Country Mouse City Mouse.
Now, was this at the farmers markets?
Yes, it started exclusively at farmers markets. We did Trader's Point Creamery, Broad Ripple, eventually Carmel and City Market, with a what started a line of three dips and two salad dressings.
So did you? So you came up with these recipes, you and your sister, and it was kind of a hit. I mean, I remember back in the day at the farmers market seeing you guys there.
Yeah, it was. It definitely had a bit of a viral, you know, eventual cult following that we really didn't expect, but was a, you know, an amazing result of us starting the company. And yeah, they were very popular, and we got to do a lot of very cool things. We eventually went into retail and got into Whole Foods and Good Earth and you know, several retail outlets.
So now, when was that? You said about 8 years ago, is that right?
Yeah, it'll be 9 years in May. Crazy. And the baby is now 10 and a half.
Well, so there we go. Now, that's the thing with kids. You have your little monitor right there of how long it's been. So you were in the farmer's markets, and I remember it going very well. You know, that Romesco sauce, the chimichurri sauce, the compound butters. Where did it go from there?
We had a request to put a shelf-stable product into baskets that were going to the Super Bowl, and I made a Bloody Mary mix, just sent it off and took what I had left over from developing the recipes and sold it at the farmers markets, and a little thing called Who's Your Mama was born out of that.
So, all right, so you're a co-founder of Who's Your Mama, and that that business took off. And that went very well, got a lot of national attention.
Yeah, it eventually grew to the point that we were no longer able to do the markets, the weekly markets. The demand as far as just day-to-day business operations was too high. So we moved into distribution and grew the brand into the wonderful product that it is today.
So then you left the company. You left Who's Your Mama, and so then where did you find yourself then?
I left Who's Your Mama about 2 years ago, and honestly, didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was teaching at Ivy Tech. I was tending bar and didn't really know if I wanted to jump back into entrepreneurship at that point, but we had people encouraging us, pushing us really hard to get back into beverage because they believed in what we were able, what I was able to achieve in that space. And so we eventually gave into the pressure and started looking to develop a new company.
Now, I assume, knowing you, I imagine your ideas are running through your head all the time. So you probably had a lot of possibilities of things that you could turn your attention to. How do you narrow something down? How do you go, this seems like a good idea or that seems like a good idea? How do you pick one and are able to focus on that?
My husband, Stephen, and I are firm believers in things happening for a reason, life taking you in the direction that it's supposed to take you in. And so we were conceptualizing several companies, really not putting all of our eggs in any one basket because we didn't know what opportunities would present themselves. And so we were giving our attention to several projects, feeling confidently that eventually the right one would take the lead. And I was at home one day and thinking about what we were going to do next and sent Stephen a text that simply said, the wine cooler grows up. And we stopped all efforts in any other direction and immediately started developing Garden Party.
So Garden Party, tell me what that is. It's not really a wine cooler, though.
It's not. There's a category that started to really emerge in and of itself called the hard soda. And you see it with the explosion of Not Your Father's Root Beer and Henry's Hard Sodas, all of which were based around nostalgic kind of retro flavors. And, we didn't know whether we wanted to do malt-based, wine-based, grain-neutral spirits. There are pros and cons to all of those when it comes to legalities, taxes, and logistics. And with the emergence of the hard soda category, it showed us that that was definitely the right path to take this as far as developing it into the brand that we're now launching.
So you're launching Garden Party Hard Sodas. Now tell me just a little bit about that, and we'll talk more about that in a little bit. But tell me just a little bit about Garden Party.
The coolest thing about kind of the development of the flavors are that these are both flavors that that we sold under the Country Mouse City Mouse name.
Oh, now that's cool. So this does harken back to your days at the farmers market.
Yeah, we sold a lemonade that was flavored with blackberry and lavender, and we did a hibiscus ginger iced tea, and those are both reflected in the two flavors that we're launching with.
And what are the flavors' names?
Violet is a crisp lemon soda with lavender and blackberry, and Ruby is a spicy ginger soda with hibiscus and pomegranate.
Oh my goodness. And so these are going to be rolling out very soon, yes?
Next week. So you will start seeing them on the shelves of grocery and package stores as well as restaurants and bars starting in November.
We've been talking with entrepreneur Aaron Eds of Garden Party Botanical Hard Sodas. Stay with us for more with Aaron here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Lots of people, it seems, have a great product idea. They come up with a recipe or a special dish and just know there would be fans out there if only they could get it out there to them. Lots of us would have stopped at that "if only I could" point and decided it just wouldn't happen. But local entrepreneur Erin Eds knew she had a great idea for a line of hard sodas and set about making it happen. But going from an idea to having your product produced, packaged, and sitting on a table in front of you isn't easy. And in Erin's case, to have a can of her new Garden Party Botanical Hard Soda sitting there on a table meant that 18,000 cases were produced this past week. I sat down with Erin to hear how that actually happened, how she and her husband Stephen took an idea for a canned alcoholic beverage in a new category, hard sodas, from inspiration to production, and how her years of selling Country Mouse City Mouse products and Hoosier Mama Bloody Mary mix at local farmers markets has come full circle with Garden Party Hard Sodas.
It started out, we worked with a company that has it's called a concept to market program, where they take your idea and develop the commercial formulations. It was never in my skill set to brew or to distill. So, you know, our background is in creating products and scaling them, but the logistics involved in creating this particular carbonated alcoholic beverage was way beyond anything that we were familiar at that time with.
So you find someone to believe in your idea and to kind of make it happen.
Yeah, and that was actually not as easy as it sounds. This particular group, it took us a year for them to accept us into this program. Their services are complimentary, understanding that you will eventually be buying these flavor compounds from them. So they don't bring anybody on until they're fully convinced that you're actually going to go to market.
Now, that must be a big step, though, to go from this, what you think is a great idea, to actually having someone say, okay, we're going to start manufacturing it?
Yes. So our next step in the process was contracting with our logistics management team at BevSource. They're based in St. Paul, Minnesota, and they handle everything from working with the can manufacturers, the box manufacturers, and the actual brewers, the contract brewers themselves. And so we joined forces with them in February and are already ready to launch. So their involvement has really helped to speed up the trajectory of the launch.
Now tell me about the concept of the product. So it's hard sodas, but this is a kind of a high concept product. You know, it's there's personality here.
Yeah, at first in the development, I really wanted to lean towards sort of the LaCroix model, you know, low sugar, subtle flavors, very crisp and refreshing, and they've definitely led the premiumization of the carbonated beverage category, and we wanted to do the same thing in the hard soda category, be the leaders in elevating hard sodas to being a premium product.
So now, tell me a little bit about coming up with the concept, you know, the personalities. There's a lot of stuff going on just looking at the label.
There, again, is somebody else that we've been able to add to our team that has been absolutely invaluable. You know, we had the name, we had the concept, we had very little branding developed beyond what was just happening in our heads. And we are fortunate enough to be distributed in Indiana by Monarch Beverage. Monarch has an in-house design firm led by a gentleman named Jeff Brown. And Jeff is the one that has developed our branding, our logo, and the look of what our retail and packaging looks like.
Well, now tell me how you describe it, because it's pretty festive and fun looking. So tell me your thoughts on that.
Yeah, we joke that it's a party in a box. You know, our packages are four pack 12 ounce cans. The cans are slender and very, very, they're just beautiful products. And we wanted something that people were going to be excited about serving at everything from a bridal shower to, you know, throwing in their cooler for the 500, something that was going to be versatile and, you know, light and refreshing and great to consume when you're out, you know, doing your outdoor stuff, but still something that you would sit and enjoy at a very nice brunch.
Now tell me the flavors. You have ruby and violet. So tell me a little bit about the flavors.
Violet is going to be, I think, everybody, or not everybody's favorite, but I think it's going to be the, you know, the public favorite. It's just this beautiful, bright lavender color, great carbonation. It's tart. It has a lot of lemon with the kind of juicy blackberry and the herbal notes from the lavender. The cool thing about this, too, is the versatility of the product. I don't really think of another hard soda as being a mixer, but this absolutely can serve as a mixer too. Violet is great with Prosecco or Cava, also pairs really well with clear spirits like vodka or gin. Ruby is spicy. I have never been able to find a ginger beer that has enough ginger for me. And so I said, let's just make this really nice and spicy with the floral hibiscus and the kind of tart pomegranate. It pairs really well, too, with sparkling wine, but also makes a really good Moscow Mule and also pairs very well with bourbon.
So I love this story. So tell me just a little bit about your thoughts on how it all happened, because a lot of people have an idea. You know, they have an idea for a business. Oh, wouldn't this be great? But you made that happen, right? You know, right here in Indianapolis. So tell me a little bit about the process.
Yeah, I think for us, having this be, you know, my third venture, you know, we've learned a lot of really great and very important lessons. One of the biggest ones is build a team around you that can help you, you know, find out the answers if you don't know. Don't be afraid to ask for help. I think that that's been really important for us, is recognizing where, you know, what our skill set is and where we needed to shore that up. So, you know, putting people around us that could help us figure out the yeses, but also tell us the noes, and, you know, helping us reach the right business decisions. Because I mean, you can have a product all day long, but unless you build a successful business around it as well, with all of the pieces in place to be a sustainable company, it doesn't matter how good the product is.
So now what will you be doing next? So the product is going to roll out next week. And so this is your hard sodas. People will start to see them in stores, right?
Yes. So Monarch, again, will be doing our distribution. What we'll be doing from here is as many events as we can. We really think it's important for people to understand the concept of the flavors. The best way for us to do that is to have them try it. And so, you know, you'll be able to find us at different events, you know, liquor store tastings. Unfortunately, you can't do spirits tastings at grocery stores. We'll be doing the taps. Is it called Taps and Touchdowns? The Indy Sports Corp Brew Fest that's going to be happening around the Big Ten football tournament or championship. championship. You know, we'll be doing events with Visit Indy, and just taking advantage of any opportunities that come our way to work with our, you know, work with our community like Yelp and Edible Indy and groups like that.
So we'll be seeing a lot of you over the next few weeks, several months down the road as you launch the company. So do you have any advice for entrepreneurs who are, you know, kind of sitting around thinking about their ideas? You know, here you've got this hard soda ready to launch.
Getting proof of concept is really important.
So. Now tell me what that means.
If you have a product or an idea that you really love, get it in front of as many people as you possibly can. If it's a recipe, test it out on your friends and family. Offer to go into small groceries and do tasting and sampling. You know, do community events if you can. Get into farmers markets. I mean, farmers markets are absolutely an amazing platform to launch food-based companies. You know, you get immediate feedback, and I will tell you that people at the farmers markets are not shy about telling you what they think of things.
So this all kind of ties back into your history of launching at the farmers markets. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's an amazing full circle. And I think the most important part of that whole thing is just being engaged with your audience and, you know, becoming, you know, part of the community that you want to, you know, eventually, you know, be your champion.
Now, where can people go for more information? You have a gorgeous website. I want to point that out.
The website, right now it's just a landing page, but the full website should be up in the next week or so. It is www.drinkgp, that's G as in garden party, .com. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram.
So people can follow you for updates on where they can find Garden Party and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we will have a tasting menu, a tasting schedule up, so you'll know where to find us for events. And we will be updating several times a week as far as outlets that are carrying it for sale as well.
So are you excited about this? I just have to ask.
Not at all. Yeah, we're super excited. It's been an amazing year, and now the fun starts.
We've been talking with Erin Eds of Garden Party Botanical Hard Sodas. For more information on Ruby Violet and the Garden Party Company, go to drinkgp.com or look for Garden Party on Facebook. The idea of rural farm life can sound idyllic. You're surrounded by nature and fields, and there must be plenty of fresh local food, right? Well, as it turns out, that isn't always the case. Morristown-based writer and editor Sherry Duggar, who's the editor of Farm Indiana and South Magazine, discovered when she moved to her Shelby County farm that just because you live out in the country, you don't necessarily have access to an abundance of local food. So that set an idea in motion. As a local food advocate, Sherry knew that a lot of producers were out there, so what if she figured out a way to bring that local food to her rural community? And so the idea for the farm store at Duggar Family Farm was born. Sherry and her husband Randy launched the store on their Morristown farm this past summer, and response has been encouraging as neighbors discover the little store and then in turn help support other local farmers, producers, and food artisans. Sherry tells us how the farm store came about.
We are Duggar Family Farm, and we have started up a farm store back in July of this year. We opened up our farm store. We had a grand opening. We are mainly selling Indiana foods. There's some stuff from Ohio and a couple of things that fall in there, but mostly it's Indiana-made foods. Raised here, made here by Indiana food makers, and we're just trying to promote local food in an area. We live in Morristown, Indiana, so there's not a lot of food options around here. So the idea was to bring in foods that are make it convenient for our neighbors to be able to get food whenever they need it, as well as to promote local food that's made in our state.
So how do you get to the point of opening a little store on your farm?
back in, I think it was around March, where I came up with the idea to, I was actually writing a grant that we were going to, we didn't get it this year. I'm going to reapply. I'm going to make some changes with our partnerships that we had and reapply for next year. But my husband restores old cars and motorcycles, and we're going to potentially restore an old Model A truck and turn it into a mobile food truck. And so part of that grant application that I wrote, that I started writing in March, was to have this small food store. That was going to be the first step in this progress of all the things that we want to do. We want to have the small food store. We want to have a truck to be able to go out into food deserts and distribute this food and to be able to sell it. We just got accepted to take SNAP benefits, so we'll have the equipment for that. And hopefully we can create a community here on our property, as well as to be able to go out into the streets and get food made by Hoosiers and get it into the hands of Hoosiers who need it.
Now, I think people are fairly well aware of the problem of food deserts in the city, mm-hmm. but food deserts exist out in rural areas as well, even though we're surrounded by corn and soybean fields.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I know that there is, one main problem is that there's a lot of food insecurity in these rural areas. They don't have access to good food, good wholesome food out here. So in Morristown, for example, we don't have a real grocery store. We have the Dollar General. And we have, there's a small market, I think, that might have just opened up that might sell some foods, but, and it had tried before to make it, but it was mostly processed foods that was in there. So it wasn't even vegetables and meats and cheeses and that sort of thing. So,
yeah, I think that's a little, you know, startling to realize that in the midst of, you know, the harvest bounty that is Indiana in the fall, mm-hmm. you know, that there's, you know, food deserts right there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's sad, actually. And a lot of people, you know, the same problems you have in the city where they don't know how to cook the food. They don't know. They didn't grow up cooking the food. They didn't grow up eating the whole foods. So they have the same problems out here as well. They have an access problem. They have a use problem. They have a storage problem sometimes. So it's a lot of the same problems that you see in the urban areas.
So you can't just say, you know, everybody's got a backyard garden and they're all canning vegetables and that sort of thing. So that's an idealized vision of rural Indiana, probably.
Right. And I think it's an old one to a degree. A lot of people, I think it's coming back around for sure. But I think the idea that people are doing those things is kind of past. So, unfortunately.
So how did you come to be living out in rural Shelby County? Mm-hmm. With chickens and goats and are those llamas? Alpacas?
Yeah, alpacas. We have a couple of foster alpacas. I have taken a long road. I think I wrote a bio about myself once where I flew the coop and I went to New York City and lived there for several years right out of college. I graduated from IU, made my way back to the Midwest through Columbus, Ohio first, and then made my way back to Indianapolis. I lived in Garfield Park. I bought in Garfield Park because I saw a vision there that I thought it was going to turn into something. And it did pretty much the day we moved out. It was like a blossoming of restaurants and awesomeness going on. But we sold our house there and we moved out to the country. Along the way, I started kind of romanticizing the idea of, you know, kind of getting back to the land. I'd started gardening by that point. I had grown up and kind of, you know, started cooking more and teaching myself the things that I didn't even, you know, I grew up eating SpaghettiOs and didn't, just a long road from south side of Indianapolis, New York City, and back to the country. So,
now you have been a writer along the way, an editor. How does that translate now into creating a different sort of lifestyle in the country and building a store and that sort of thing?
Well, I'm an editor, so I like to actually edit Farm Indiana. So we tell stories about farmers around Indiana in that publication. And that's kind of what I like to do, is to be able to tell people's stories, whether it's through storytelling in the store. I love having these conversations with people that come in and they actually ask about the food makers and they ask about what they're buying. So I like creating those conversations, whether it's in print, whether it's with somebody that walks into the door, and being able to tell those stories of what our fellow Hoosiers are doing.
So what are they doing? What are some of the products that you have in the store? And how have you built an inventory? I mean, you have a lot of stuff in a small space.
That's what I like to say. It's mighty. It's small but mighty. It's been a learning process of going out and, you know, contacting people, looking at people who, like you, who post stuff on Facebook or online, and being able to find the the people who are making these foods and Tiny Footprint comes out here and delivers, and different Piazza, I've become a customer of them as well. But it's also just having those conversations. I have people who walk in here and they're like, oh, I make this or I make that. And, you know, then we start having that conversation. I go to Troyer's, the Amish country store in Milroy. So there's a lot of different places where I spend my time driving and trying to find these places and trying to get more product in. So.
And what's been the reaction among your neighbors? The neighbors out here, I assume, are close by. I don't see any looking right out the window. I look across to a cornfield. But what's been the reaction to people nearby?
Oh, they really love it. I think that a lot of people are grateful that there's food options out here. We also have people who can order at farmersmarket.com and hoosierharvestmarket.com, and they can actually pick up their orders here. And I've had people who said, you know, who have said they were very frustrated with living out in the country, and now that they know this option exists, I have one woman who's started to order from farmersmarket.com and Hoosier Harvest Market every week, and she's having food delivered here, specifically what she wants, made by Hoosier Makers. It comes here, and she drives 3 seconds over to our house and picks it up every Thursday.
Well, now that must be gratifying. Did you expect this sort of thing to happen when you had this idea for a market at your house?
I don't think I knew what to expect. I think I just came up with the idea and said, honey, let's make a store. So it was, you know, it was a learning experience and being able to figure out, okay, this is what we need to do to set up the store. And then hope for the best. You know, you don't know. I still don't know if it'll succeed 5 years from now or not. But our idea is this is the first step in this larger plan that we have to build a community center out here, to build a workshop, to build a commercial kitchen, and to have a lot of things going on this property that helps people learn how to do things and helps them get a hold of the foods that will hopefully help our local food system grow in ways that it needs to.
We've been talking with Sherry Duggar of Duggar Family Farm in Morristown, Indiana. Stay with us for more from Sherry here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Living on a farm, raising chickens and goats and alpacas, and launching a store that sells locally made products? Well, for many in the local food community, that certainly sounds like a goal. And that's what Sherry Duggar of Duggar Family Farm in Morristown is doing. But it wasn't necessarily a natural progression. Sherry grew up on the south side of Indianapolis and wanted to get out of town and into the big city. And as a punk rock roller derby girl, local food wasn't really a priority. But life's a journey, right? And Sherry eventually found her way back to Indiana and into the local food movement, where she's been at home ever since. Sherry, a writer and editor of Farm Indiana and South Magazine, operates Duggar Family Farm with her husband Randy, and last summer opened a small store on the farm. She also has a local food podcast called 8-7. I asked Sherry to fill us in on the life experiences that led her back to Indiana and onto her own farm.
Definitely wasn't a farm girl. I grew up on the south side of Indianapolis and like I said, went to the big city. So it's been a progression over the years of kind of coming into myself, growing up a little bit, maturing a little bit, and realizing that everything that I do has an impact, whether a good one or a bad one, I have a choice to make. And that's as I've grown up and I've changed over the years, I realized that I wanted to have as good of an impact as I could. I've said to my girlfriend Stevie before, you know, what kind of legacy are we going to leave? And we've had that discussion many times, and she shares the same heart that I do for animals and for rescue animals and for taking care of critters that might have not had such a good life. And so as I moved out here, I realized my life has been blessed. I've you know, had very good jobs, and I've had very good experiences so far, and I wanted to kind of share that with you know, animals who might not have had such good possibilities. So we've been able to take on some goats that might have had an otherwise, they're all boys. They don't do anything. They don't create milk. They just cause trouble. We have chickens that we do sell their eggs in our store, but the alpacas are rescue alpacas. Actually, one of them we're about to adopt, and the other one is old enough that he's a permanent foster with us. So they're basically ours, and they're staying with us. And we have dogs and cats, and I just, like I said, I you know, have come to really adore the animals over time. And it's part of my way that I can give back and a little bit of what I've been given and give some of that love to the critters and to be able to take care of them. I would love to start a nonprofit animal rescue. That might happen in the future. Maybe, maybe not. That is one of the things that's on my mind, as well as a couple of other options for what we want to do with our property. But it's just been a progression.
So how did it, how did you come from, if people might remember you in Indianapolis as a roller derby girl. So how do you go from a punk rock roller derby girl to raising a big garden in the Garfield Park area to now out on a farm?
That's a learning curve. So I really, actually, as I also grew up, I learned to eat well. I watched my dad, who just passed away this past summer, suffer with cancer and heart problems and diabetes and high blood pressure, and he had a number of problems. And really, his only vice in his lifetime was food. And my uncle, who is older than him and still with us and is very healthy and used to ride long distance on bicycles and do all kinds of stuff more athletically, really, and has been, was wonderful for my dad to be able to help him. My dad was in a chair for the last probably 4 years of his life and wasn't really able to enjoy life as much as he should have and could have. But, you know, I came to, as I got older, look at those two men in my life who were very important and who I loved dearly. And I realized I had a choice as well in how I treated my own body. I used to smoke cigarettes. I used to eat chips all the time. I was overweight, you know, for most of my life. I never exercised. And it was really a personal choice of like, okay, I need to realize that I need to treat my body one way or the other. And I will, you know, see my demise at some point anyway, but if I can help myself at all along the way, then I need to try and do that. So it became something about, you know, maybe even respecting myself a little bit more, and learning how to cook and enjoying food, because you get foods whenever they're made small batch, whenever they're made with whole foods, whenever they're made and grown in a different way, you get foods that really taste a lot better. So it was a matter of taste. It was a matter of my health and caring for my own body. And it was a matter of having just more awareness about how this world works and really understanding nature, you know, the cycle of it.
Now, you did start gardening when you lived on the south side of Indianapolis. How did that develop? I mean, that was an awesome garden, if I remember right.
It was a slow progress as well. It was just starting with some beans and some tomatoes and just seeing what would happen. At that time, we had a very small garden, and every year, whenever something works, I get a little crazy with it. So I got bigger. The garden got bigger and bigger each year, and it was, you know, a small quarter-acre lot, but I had a lot of food growing in there, and whatever was in that soil in Garfield Park was amazing. So everything that I grew in there really grew well. I had cantaloupes, I had Brussels sprouts, I had, you know, cauliflowers and broccoli and just sweet potatoes galore. And green beans galore and everything. And that was where I really, learned how to, you know, start canning and cooking and storing food.
So you have been a part of this, you know, return to, that's the interest in those sorts of things, you know, like you said, the canning and the preserving. Did you take to that easily? Was that also a progression?
It is still a progression. I don't think I'm by any stretch a really good cook, but I try. I like to make cornbread, and we make jams. We actually sell jams under our own line here out of the store. And so, you know, it is a progression of what do we have time to do? Lately, we haven't had time to do a lot of anything in terms of canning because we've just been so busy with the store and keeping the property up and taking care of the animals. But that is one thing that's very important to us. We make, you know, as much as we can. And we grow as much as we can, and we have time to keep up. So we had a big garden this year, and we want to get a high tunnel next year and start growing more and producing more and being able to sell more out of our store as well.
Now, tell me about the store, because that's starting to seem like a natural progression of how you live your life.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it is. I want everything that I do to be able to support this local food scene, as well as the people who are trying to make their ways, you know, with their independently, of larger systems. I really want to support our local people. I want to support Hoosiers and what they're trying to do. So what we try to do is to provide that service, to be able to bring food to people who might not have access to it, or might not even know about it, or might not understand why they should know about it. So what I'm trying to do in every step of my career professionally as an editor and a writer, as well as running the store and how we run our farm, inviting people here to educate them and being able to, you know, to promote those ideas and those concepts.
Now, give me a little bit of the details on the farm, its name, where it's located, how people can find more information.
We are at Duggar Family Farm. We are at in Morristown, Indiana. We are on 6559 East 1200 North in Morristown, Indiana. We are located about 35 minutes outside of Indianapolis, just about midway between Greenfield and Shelbyville.
And so if people want more information?
Yeah, they can go to our website at duggarfamilyfarm.com, and it's D-U-G-G-E-R, not A-R. I know there's another family on TV with Duggar name, but that's not us. They can find us on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter.
We've been talking with Sherry Duggar of Duggar Family Farm in Morristown. For information on the farm and store, look for it on Facebook and at duggarfamilyfarm.com. This week here on Eat, Drink, Indiana Radio, we head back into the kitchen for a Cook This segment, this time with Ryan Nelson, chef owner at Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue and Moonshine in Indianapolis. But before I met Ryan at Late Harvest Kitchen, I stopped in at Kincaid's Meat Market to pick out something for the chef to cook. After considerable discussion with the butcher, we finally settled on lamb top sirloin. And the butcher and I were both guessing it would end up as some sort of stew. But we were both wrong. I have to say, I don't cook lamb very much. You know, it's I like it. I enjoy it out. But I guess it's not anything that I ever think about.
I think lamb sometimes, like duck, has sort of a special occasion feel to it.
Right.
I also think, for me, it's also it's a heartier meat. So it's something you typically have, like, fall or winter. Like, we do a lot of shanks.
Right.
In the wintertime. In fact, they're kind of a staple on the menu. I guess a little bit around Easter, too. Like, we'll do some legs and stuff like that.
Right. I guess I think of Easter, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Or maybe I think Moroccan food or something like that.
Well, I think let's go in that direction, maybe. I've got we have a vegetable tagine that we do on the menu here, and I have some of those spices in-house. And why don't we do, like, a lamb tartare with some North African spices and some bread and go from there.
Sure. Well, whatever you think.
All right, cool.
All right, so tell me what you're doing right now.
I am going to dice up this sirloin as small as I can. Hand cut tartare. I feel like I'm cheating a little bit when it says cook this and I'm doing a raw dish, but...
Well, and you know, it's all about inspiration and maybe looking at things in a different way.
I agree. That and I think that you're probably cool with raw dishes, and yeah, not everybody is.
Well, that is a good point. So maybe it wouldn't be something somebody would even consider.
Gotta cook for your audience.
Why would you go this route?
I think it just kind of sounded good.
So are you thinking as you go along, or do you get an idea? All at once, you know?
I kind of get an idea and then work towards it. Mm-hmm. And then if I need to change, you know, midstream, you know, go for it. You know, usually just seasoning, things like that. But this is, I really enjoy knife work. It's a great way to start the day. It's kind of...
Okay, so tell me where we are now in the process.
I've got all of my mise en place set, so that's kind of generally how I like to do things, is I like to have everything set up and then proceed rather than kind of cook as I go.
Do you do that at home? Do you even cook much at home?
I do on Sundays. That's the only day I take off. And my wife likes it when I cook, but she hates the mess because I'll sometimes literally just like do this and like forget that I'm not at work. And yeah. Also, I'll have like 10 different ramekins out with like different ingredients in it. She doesn't really like that either.
But it does make a difference when you're cooking, all right, to have everything all ready. And I think that's one of the things at home that really helps, you know?
Much easier. Much more enjoyable. Especially, too, if you're entertaining. You know, you want to be a part of the party, too. When you have tartare in France or over in Europe, like, they just put it through a grinder, and then they put it out on the plate, and it looks like ground beef. It looks like hamburger.
Right, yeah, so there's...
yeah. It can be off-putting.
Well, I wonder, you know, and if people would go for that.
Yeah.
You know, the there was another person at the butcher shop, you know, and the butcher's suggesting things. Oh, you know, how about elk or something like this? And I'm going, oh, you probably like that. You can do that. And she's going, ooh, no, you know. And so I didn't know if some people are still off-put. off-put by that, really?
Kinda. Okay. They're lean and, I mean, like bison and stuff like that, too. It's hard, I think, harder to get, you know, a lot of flavor out of stuff like that.
Right.
You know.
Yeah,
this is nice lamb.
Do you have trouble getting people to try interesting things, or do they pretty much trust you now after all these years?
We still kind of play it safe and cook for the crowd. I mean, we could be more adventurous, but I think that you want people to be happy, and you know, so what might be adventurous for some is not for others. So we just try and do the best food we can at the business level that we operate at. So it's all about dishes for me are all about scalability. Sure. Like how great or how good can we make it at the speed or at the business level with which we're operating.
Right. So you're not necessarily cooking for you and your tastes, right?
Yes and no. I mean, you have to, you know, you gotta play to everybody.
Right.
But you want to, you know, you want to be successful, so.
That's right.
Yeah.
Right.
There's certain, I think we've talked about this before, like how certain menus, how a menu has to have certain things. Like you have to have a couple fish, you have to have a chicken, you have to have a steak, you have to have this, you have to have that. And then by the end of those sort of things being fulfilled, you know, what's left or, you know, how many spots are left on the menu, you know, that you can play with.
So are there cuts that people should look at more that they don't look at, you know, things that, you know, people tend to fall into the rut, you know, the pork chop, the chicken, the steak, the pasta or whatever, the things people should look at more often than they do?
I think that there's a lot of flavor in off cuts. You know, like we were talking before, like beef cheeks or pork cheeks or shin meat or, you know, tongue or all kinds of stuff.
But so maybe we're missing out.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I think that's also one of the reasons why you go to restaurants.
Right.
You know?
Right. Because you're supposed to, you know, think about these things and show us the interesting stuff. I mean, some people go to restaurants for something interesting. Other people, you know, they want that steak, right?
Sure. Yeah, definitely.
So you have it finely minced, I guess?
Yep.
Where do you go from there?
I want to cool it. I want to get really cold. And then we're going to prepare the rest of our ingredients that we're going to mix it with and garnish it with.
The herbs smell great, so
yeah,
tell
super,
me what you got.
Super aromatic. I've got cilantro, curly leaf parsley, and some basil, which is really, really nice.
And you grow this at the restaurant, some of this, right?
We do. We try and not pay for herbs in the summer months. Plus, it's nice to, you know, walk out there and, you know, it smells wonderful. I think parsley is the most underrated herb.
How so?
I mean, for years and years and years, there was just like a sprig of it on a plate, and that's all it was used. But I think it's fantastic with eggs or in salads or raw. I just love parsley.
What is that?
It's like a Tunisian or North African version of chimichurri. So we've got all kinds of spices in here. Coriander, cinnamon, sugar, a lot of parsley, some cilantro, a little bit of chili, some argan oil, which I see on my wife's like moisturizers and shampoos. It's kind of funny. It's like, oh, we cook with that. But it's like North African chimichurri, like a condiment. Mm-hmm. Yep. And that'll go great with the lamb. And I've got some apricot chutney that we do a vegetable tagine here. And it's just dried apricots, some herbs, a little bit of sugar, little bit of onion, nice sweetness. So we'll do just a tiny bit of that too.
Okay, so tell me what you're doing.
I just toasted off a little bit of brioche, some brioche that we make here in-house, and I let the tartare marinate for a bit just to kind of let the flavors come together, and now I'm going to plate it and kind of bring everything together just at the end. Okay. And then I like to use the egg. That's kind of a classic, to have the chopped egg or the hard-cooked egg with beef tartare. Some people put a raw yolk on or do it that way. I like to just use just the cooked eggs. I think this is just interesting, maybe on the side. Maybe put it on the toast and then maybe add...
That's the apricots, right?
That's that chutney, that apricot chutney, which I think like a little marmalade, and then the tartare. It could go nice together. Church it up a little bit with the... Make it look nice and pretty. Voila.
Describe it for me all together.
Okay, we took a lamb sirloin and chopped it up very fine, cooled it down, and then added some shallots, some garlic, a little bit of radish. I added some charmoula, which is a North African chimichurri, if you will. We've got some hard-cooked eggs as a garnish, some fresh herbs from the garden, a little bit of apricot chutney, and then I've got some brioche soldiers, if you will, for the vehicle.
And this is something somebody could do at home, and it didn't take all that long, but it's knowing what goes together and what flavors are going to work, right?
Correct. Lamb and North African flavors go really well together.
We've been in the kitchen with Chef Ryan Nelson, owner of Late Harvest Kitchen and the North End Barbecue in Moonshine. For more information on Ryan's restaurants, go to lateharvestkitchen.com and thenorthendbbq.com. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, where we talk local food every week on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for listening in today, and thanks also to our guests, Aaron Eds of Garden Party Hard Soda, Sherry Duggar of Duggar Family Farm in Morristown, and Chef Ryan Nelson of Late Harvest Kitchen in Indianapolis. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio.